Welcome back to Fear or Favour. This week we're going to talk about a number of different subjects, but one of the things that's really, really got to me was this apology by the Metropolitan Police in relation to a shocking, and truly shocking, incident that occurred back in 2020. So the background to it is that a schoolgirl, a black schoolgirl, was strip searched by the police after being suspected of carrying cannabis. Now, that came to the police's attention because the school contacted the police. Two police officers turn up, two female police officers. They take this young girl into a separate room. The members of the staff stay outside and they require her to do a full body strip search, including having to take off her sanitary towel. They find no drugs. The police then left that matter as it was. But of course, it was then further reported. And a safeguarding report has now identified and concluded that it was unjustified and racism was likely to have been a factor. The police have apologised. Detective Superintendent Dan Rutland from the Metropolitan Police has apologised. He recognised the findings of the safeguarding review and that this incident should never have happened. And it's truly regrettable. Nazir, I'm aghast. I find myself week on week getting more and more angry on this podcast. Yeah. How on earth did they think that was acceptable?
Well, nobody can think that. No rational being. Strangely, Mark, I knew it was a black person. I didn't look at the fact that it was a black person until, you know, halfway down the article, and then I realised, it's a black girl. But anybody, I think, would have guessed that it was. We know that the figures suggest that if you're a black person, you're nine times more likely to be stopped and searched than if you're a white person, regardless of what time of day or what the evidence is, etc. So we knew that was the case. I don't know what was going through their minds. It's as simple as that. First, I mean, I'm not criticize the school. Let's criticize the school. Yeah. I mean, there was an overreaction on their part. They needed to have contacted her carer, her parent. They should have had an appropriate adult there. That's the law. All of those things weren't followed. The officers then did, you know, I mean, I can't think of a word other than torture, really. I mean, doing that to a child is
the humiliation of it. Humiliation.
Absolutely. And nothing found. Here we are, 18 months later, getting an apology. You know, we've said before on this podcast, an apology is a waste of time if it doesn't include accountability. You know, who is going to be held responsible for this? And what guarantees are there? What guarantees are there that it won't be repeated? People are, as you say, not only aghast, they're just concerned that this is the latest in a saga of incompetence on the part of the Metropolitan Police.
There was an interesting element of that safeguarding review that said, and you just alluded to it yourself, had this girl had been white, the chances are the process that took place wouldn't have taken place, i.e. they wouldn't have taken it to the manner that they did.
Yeah, and the safeguarding review is an independent review carried out by people looking at all the evidence, and they came to that conclusion, and you know, there can be really no other conclusion. They treated her with the disdain that they did because they thought they could. It's a power thing, and they exerted their power on the most innocent of individuals in the most despicable of circumstances. And it has caused massive repercussions. Just looking on social media, people are, trying to name the school. I think it's inappropriate to do that because, you know, she's still there. So, you know, you don't want to put other children at risk. And similarly, the officers themselves haven't been named. But as I said a moment ago, there needs to be accountability. It can't just be, as it often is, lessons will be learned and lessons are never learned.
No, I mean, I think the problem is the school made serious mistakes. You know, the school, however they reacted to this, it seems like a massive overreaction. And then as a result of that, the police coming in and allowing the police to take this young girl who was under the care of the school into a room on her own. And that raises so many questions for me around the school safeguarding process. Yeah. And then accountability. We talk week on week about officers, and sadly, overwhelmingly Metropolitan Police officers. Yep. But, you know, when I deal with somebody, and I know you well enough, Nazir, that you're exactly the same, is that I treat people as I would expect to be treated myself, as members of my family I would expect to be treated. So whether that was my daughter or my sister, that's how I would expect them to be treated, and I would do exactly the same. But clearly, that is not what took place here. These officers, whatever reason they had behind it, the proportionality of it was not there.
That's
and secondly, the humiliation for this young girl. I mean, when I read it and it said, you know, searching her intimate body parts, and we can all guess what that means.
Yeah.
But to get this young girl to remove her sanitary towel in a when she's already at a vulnerable position. This is a young girl, you know, who's on a period at school, already in a vulnerable position. To be able to do that, and these officers, you know, these officers need to be held to account. They should be being properly disciplined for this.
Yeah, absolutely. And their supervisors, you know, we want to know what happened afterwards, you know, who was told, who wasn't told. Mark, you made it's a very valid point that this young girl now will have next to no confidence in policing. Mm. Her family will have next to no confidence in policing. The community around her will have next to no. It has repercussions. Yeah. It's not just what happens, what terrible things happen to this young girl. It's now, can you trust the police? And we've spoken before and we'll speak again about the fact that trust is the key to good policing. And now we've got a situation where people in Hackney and people in that environment and beyond will now be thinking, well, can we possibly trust them?
Yeah, no, it has a massive repercussions, as you say. Let's look at this other case, which again, I mean, I know you've commented on it, and I just cannot understand. So here we have a Russian oligarch, Oleg Dipraska, I think I've said that right, who owns this property. Well, he says he doesn't directly own it. It's owned by members of his family. And this property was basically squatted. A number of individuals took over it and said that they were going to make it available for refugees and other people to take because this individual, Dipraska, was is a prominent Russian businessman, pro-Kremlin, and he's very close with the Russian government and Putin himself.
And he's been sanctioned.
Yep. And he's been sanctioned, crucially, yes, absolutely. Yep. He's been sanctioned, so he's on the government list, sanctions list. But, and herein lies the question that I haven't seen an answer to yet. Why is it they take over that and within a matter of hours, the police have gone in there and taken them out? That just doesn't, I mean, that's not a process that you do. Why are the police getting involved in that?
No, exactly. It's a civil matter, as it always would be. Yeah, I mean, if it's residential premises, in due course, it's going to be a criminal matter. The law is changing or has changed. But there was nobody in the premises. There never is going to be anybody
unoccupied.
As we know, very often, they just buy it as an investment property. Some would say money laundering. I'm not going to say that. But, you know, the reality is that's an empty property that's been taken over by people to make a political point. Absolutely right. That's that point they made. But it's the overreaction. Six vans of police officers. The photographs show this long conga line of officers going along the street and into the building, and they face no resistance. You know, the individuals there don't intend to cause any harm. But the look, what is the look? The look is, you know, somebody said to me, was that picture taken in Russia? You know, no, it was central London. And then the Met had the audacity to issue a press release, which ended with the lines, it's what we would do anywhere else in London. And I tell you, Mark, I sent out a little message saying, could you please tell me what police officers
where
are doing?
Else?
And literally people were saying, time and time again, I've been burgled. I ring the police. They say, can you just put the glass in a bag? And we'll come and collect you when we get round to it. my car's been broken into. Go and ring your insurance company. You know, I'm being stalked. I'm being chased. We'll just take a picture of them. You know, we know policing is tight. Resourcing is tight. We know there aren't enough officers. And crime, as we have said before, is going up. But the impression they left with is there were plenty of officers, 72, 80 officers or thereabouts available to vacate this empty premises in London. When you and I, if we were the victim of crime and very serious crime, might not necessarily get anything like the same response. It goes back to the point about trust. You know, people are thinking, is the police our police? You know, police, public of the police of the public, PDM principles. Is it that? Or is it the government's police? Is it the state's police, which is, of course, what we can we always accuse dictatorial regimes of doing. And the impression they left with is that if you are very, 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 very rich and your property is occupied in this way, they will come out immediately to deal with it. But if you and I are the victims of crime and we're just normal citizens without the influence or power, they will ignore us. And I can't believe
why do you think the police have lost this compass, really? I mean, we've got to a situation now, repeatedly we talk week after week about the police, and then we'll talk about another one in a minute, the Sarah Everard
protest. The Metropolitan Police, both examples we've given the Metropolitan Police, the one we're going to talk about is the Metropolitan Police. So I don't want to I always just say this, we've got 120,000 police officers in this country, the vast majority do a phenomenal job keeping us safe, investigating crime, et cetera, et cetera. And that needs to be said and always said. But you know, it comes down to leadership, doesn't it, Mark? If you know, the leaders will have said what the training was for those officers that went into that school. The leadership will have dictated what the policy would have been in relation to the unoccupied premises owned by the oligarchs. You know, and the officers just do their bidding. They follow their orders. They do their duty. So, as I say, I can't understand how somebody senior in policing can think this is a good thing for us to do, for us to regain public confidence.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that sits with the Metropolitan Police as a, you know, and I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt, they are by the largest police force in the country, therefore in Europe, and therefore the spotlight will always fall on them. And we know that so many things are very London-based as well. So there's always a spotlight that sits on London, perhaps more so than it does on the other provincial areas of the country. But even more so to get it right. And there are senior officers, whether that be sergeant, inspector, superintendent rank, who are directly on the ground taking decisions in respect of these. And I will call upon them and call them out to say, are you being controlled by your senior management? Are they telling you what to do and you are simply following because you are a yes person and you want to get up the rank to the next position? Or are you just making this decision on your own? In which case, you need to seriously think about your ability. Yeah. Now, I hope it's the latter rather than the former, because otherwise we've got a really directed senior, very top rung of management within the Metropolitan Police who have their own agenda. But it does ask those questions. Why are senior officers on the ground not making the right decisions? And is that about training? Is that about lack of ability? Is that about the fact that they are too precious about their own position and their intent to rise up the rank rather than doing the right thing? I mean, what do you think?
Sure. Again, like you, I hope it's the individual officers being competent. Because strangely, that provides more reassurance than the other view that you articulated, namely it's a cultural leadership issue that people are simply just following orders and the orders make no sense at all. I think, I've come round to thinking that there's something wrong at the top. We knew this when the commissioner resigned. We've spoken before about this and her need to do so. I can't even talk about it, Mark. I would literally think twice before doing any of the things that the police have been doing recently. And I would think this doesn't look good.
No. Right?
So let's not do it. You know, actually, you won't get criticised for not doing something as much as you would do for visibly making.
But isn't that the question? Isn't that the point? You know, the police are there to protect life and limb. You know, and that's their. They give a duty to the Queen in respect of that. But these aren't matters that we're dealing with that are around life and death. These are by and large, they're not even matters of criminality.
No.
They are matters which overwhelmingly have a public perception to them. Yeah. And the public's cooperation with the police is exactly why the police work in this country. It is a tripartite system, and the public are as much the eyes and the ears of the police. In fact, they are more so. They are the public.
The police can't be everywhere, but the public are.
The public overwhelmingly are the reason why crimes are solved. Yet we seem to have lost sight that the very people that we are, and I say we, the police, are responsible for policing, are the very people they want and they need to have on their side.
Yeah.
So before they do something,
been alienating,
like that,
they're alienating their core base.
Yes.
You know? And
ostracizing more of those people who already are on the fringes of the society of policing. So those very people who come from, and we've talked about this, from the LGBT plus community, particularly we've talked just now in terms of a black young girl. These are the very people who are already feel they are on the fringes of policing. Yet now more they get pushed to one side.
Yeah, just pushing them away rather than trying to welcome them into the room and trying to reassure them that they're on their side. It literally has got to the situation where they're not on your side. You know, I've never, ever thought that about policing. In 30 years of working in justice, as you have as well, you know, we were absolutely and totally dependent upon the citizen, the public, doing their best and doing their duty and supporting each other and ultimately supporting investigations and prosecutions. But now we have a situation where it is feeling more like an us and them scenario. And it doesn't matter what the reality is. That is the perception, and that perception becomes people's reality. I really fear for citizens who now think, well, the last thing, I mean, I joke about it sometimes, but somebody did say to me a while ago that if he was burgled, he would ring Domino's Pizza because they're more likely to turn up than a police officer. And, you know, that might be funny, but that's exactly what he believes. He believes, what's the point of involving and engaging with the police? And then, of course, that leads into vigilantism. You know, the reality is, if I've got a problem with somebody, there's no point me engaging with the police on this. I'll deal with it myself. You know, it has massive repercussions.
It does, and it becomes apathy as well. You know, this whole process of, you know, we have crime numbers every year, we have the statistics, you know, and you get to a position. I was talking recently at a university around this, around the fact that, you know, the public have now changed their attitude in terms of reporting, because they think to themselves, well, what is the point in reporting? And you know, the chances are that you'll make a phone call to the police, unless it's 999, you'll be hanging on the 101 system for quite some time. You could hang on 101 for 2 hours to get through to the police, you know, that whole process. And then you have to wait until the police come out. They may not come and see you for 3 or 4 days. You know, it's the inconvenience of all of that. And the police service now has changed so much. And it's really difficult because, you know, like you, I'm a massive supporter of the police. Yeah, I'm, as you know, ex-police myself, a huge supporter of them. You know, I have got some amazing colleagues and friends who put their life on the line every day to safeguard the public. But then you have these other individuals, and by and large, senior management or middle management, who are making these decisions, which is directly affecting the morale and the confidence the public
of the officers
on the front line. Yeah. And I can't imagine being a frontline police officer now, having to try and deal with some of these communities. You know, let's just take the young girl at the school. You know, that community now, to rebuild that as a police officer going into that community is really difficult.
You know, I don't know how they'll do it. I mean, it's really easy to lose trust, impossible to gain it. You know, how do they go back there and, you know, reassure them that this will not happen again and we've learned from this, really learned from this? That will take a long, long time. And I think, you know, just thinking about the officer sitting in those vans outside that oligarch's house, you know, thinking, I could be somewhere else tackling real crime. I could be continuing the investigation that I've started to pursue in X, Y, or Z. But I'm sat here and I've been told to go into that premises and spend the rest of the day dealing with the paperwork and everything else. You know, that is really bad tasking of very limited resource. You know, as you say, we feel for them having to do what they're doing. But obviously the ultimate impact is on us, the citizen. And, you know, I just don't get it. I really don't. You know, one of these incidents, one of these things alone would have been enough for like a public inquiry, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. But now we get so many, we're almost, there's no way we're blasé. We're just being beaten around the head with them. You know, here's another incident. Here's another. We, you know, let's talk about Sarah Everard, court hearing. You know, Sarah, the vigil took place. Reclaim the Streets, which is a group of organizations that were part of the vigil, decided to go to the High Court to get a declaration from the High Court as to whether or not the police's response was proportionate or and lawful. And the High Court decided the police were acted unlawfully because they did not consider the balance that was needed in terms of protest when they decided to interfere with that vigil. And so again, you know, a year and a half ago, when the vigil happened, a year ago when the vigil happened, we thought to ourselves, that didn't look good. No. And now we have a High Court saying it was unlawful, actually. Not only did it not look good. You know, as I said, Mark, any one of these incidents would have, I don't know, we've taken the commissioner out. I've been reading about the commissioner, by the way. She's fighting tooth and nail for a larger financial settlement.
Yes.
On the basis that Priti Patel agreed to extend her contract by 2 years. And therefore, even though that 2 years hasn't started, she should get the equivalent of 2 years' salary or best part of it in breach because the mayor is in breach of contract.
And, yeah. And I'm sure she'll get it.
A really good look there. So that really looks good, doesn't it? We've got fuel prices through the roof. We've got cost of living increases, high inflation, and our most senior leaders are after £300,000-£400,000 more. When they've been called out for their incompetence. So, what does it say about the state of the Metropolitan Police?
And you get Sarah Everard this week. So that happened, the protest was March last year. The ruling was this week, but it was this week before the oligarch situation. So they already knew what was down the road. They already knew that there was going to be a finding against them in relation to the breach of the human rights by stopping this. And the proportionality being absolutely central to this. It wasn't proportionate for them to stop this demonstration going ahead. It was a very emotive period of time. People wanted to show their disgust, but also show their unity in relation to violence against women. And the judge, I think, absolutely rightly made the right decision. And in fact, I think at the time we spoke, and I know the nation's view was, from what we've seen, was that they were very supportive of it. And they were saying, why are you doing this?
Yep.
Well, the question is with that knowledge, knowing that the court was going to make that decision, why on earth did senior management within the Metropolitan Police think that it was proportionate to go into the oligarch's house within a matter of hours and ignore all those other policing issues? I'd love to know around that area just what their response time was to burglaries, to car thefts, to proper crimes when there's so many police officers were stood outside the oligarch's house.
Yeah, well, we know it's not going to be good. Of course, they would have also known that the safeguard report was coming out in relation to the Hackney child. So, this is my point. Is there any one of these incidents alone, whether it's the finding of international corruption in relation to the murder 30-odd years ago, whether it's the reaction post the murder of Sarah Everard? And the other thing, they're a multi-billion pound industry. They seem to have their communications absolutely wrong here.
Yeah.
Another example, when Sarah Everard's killer was finally convicted 6 months after her murder, then they decided to put out these memes and stuff, sign up, wave to a bus driver, a taxi driver, if you're not happy about a police officer. They had 6 months. They knew he was guilty. They knew he'd be convicted. They had 6 months to prepare a proper strategy, proper communication plan, and they came up with something that seemed to have been designed on the back of a fag packet. Mm. You know, it just stinks. The whole thing suggests to me an institution that is beyond repair. And, we've said before, I think the job of commissioner of the Metropolitan Police is impossible in the 21st century. But what we need to do is look at the organization itself. Why do they have terrorism? They shouldn't have terrorism, dealing with terrorism. Why do they have international crime? They shouldn't have international crime. bring them back to basics. A police force, just as Surrey are, just as Warwickshire are, which deals with the citizens of London and the crimes that they're concerned about. Take away responsibility for those really big political and national, international issues. You then make the job much more manageable than the one that currently stands, which I suggest is absolutely unmanageable.
I wonder, and I think you might have hit the point there. I wonder if some of this sits around their current communication department and some of the failings within that to have a proper, clear understanding from people who know what they're talking about, to understand and give a clear narrative to the public. I think that's one level. But what worries me is so the commissioner is going, and obviously there will be a new commissioner. But it's the middle management, it's the rungs below her that worry me the most, because actually they're the ones that are making these day-to-day decisions. Yep. You know, she carries the can, absolutely, she's the commissioner. But on the day-to-day decisions, she's not making those. And these are the failings that are being made by middle and lower management. And that's what worries me. What has got into the Metropolitan Police in particular that are making these terrible decisions? Is it that we've got the wrong caliber of police officers who are currently in the Metropolitan Police in those positions?
We don't know, and I wouldn't go that far. I think, don't forget, leadership set the culture. So if you have a culture where people are scared to do the right thing, where people are scared to be transparent about what they're doing, then those middle managers that are making those supervisory decisions and deciding who should be investigated or not will take their lead from who leads them. Right. So, you know, I think they're immensely capable. I mean, I know many of them, you will too, and they're immensely capable of what they do. But their response will be the response that comes from the top. So if you have a lack of transparency, and by the way, I've been talking, we need to have a conversation in a future podcast about the CPS, because I've been hearing all sorts of things about a lack of transparency in the Crown Prosecution Service currently. So, you know, institutions across the board seem to think, let's hide. Let's not tell them everything that's going on.
Yeah, becomes a cover-up, doesn't it? Becomes a cover-up. I mean, we've seen it with the BBC. You know, these big institutions, and the Metropolitan Police is one of these big institutions. You end up with a collective position that it's protect ourselves rather than be honest.
Yeah, reputation. Preservation of reputation is more important than competence. Is more important than even admitting that you've got something wrong. And of course, if you want to pretend that everything is hunky-dory, you'll never ever want to fix anything, because that automatically assumes that you've got things wrong. And for the 50,000 staff in the Metropolitan Police, the 30,000 officers and the civilian staff, you know, it must be really tough right now. They will undoubtedly, as I say, the vast majority immensely capable of what they do. I know that they are, and they're certainly being led by people who just don't seem to understand the anger that's out there amongst communities, amongst citizens.
Frontline police officers are really, really vulnerable now, you know, more so than they have ever been, because the current confidence in the police and the support of the police is, I would say, at an all-time low. You know, I've got a good friend who's a sergeant in the police, in the Met Police, and he says, you know, the morale and the whole basis of how they work at the moment is at an all-time low. They're really struggling to be able to kind of like police as they used to.
You know, it just exasperates me, because we've spent, haven't we, between us 60 years working in justice. And we've spent that time trying to improve things, to make things feel better for the citizen, for victims, for survivors, for professionals, ensure that they're more satisfied in the jobs that they do. And I look now and I see people floundering. And I see, you know, those you mentioned earlier on about the citizen. You know, the citizen, why would the citizen ring up the police if they've seen a crime or they're aware that criminals are active? Why would they, if it doesn't hurt themselves? Because they would, you know, say they would ring 999, but if it's not involving them, if they see some people acting inappropriately somewhere, why would they, when they look at what they've heard and what they've seen? You know, that is how damaging it is to us as a country, and certainly to our capital city.
I think one of the things that we get a lot of positive feedback from our listeners is the fact that we tackle issues, we address them really head on, but then we always look to try and find a solution or solutions to a problem. And I think this is probably the biggest challenge, because by and large, the other ones we've talked about are quite easy fixes. The Metropolitan Police Officer or the Metropolitan Commissioner is now going. But this requires a lot more, doesn't it, to be
it
able
does.
To fix
it
this?
It does. I know what will happen. It'll be a little bit of fiddling will go on. They'll bring somebody in who they think is capable, and nothing else will have changed. Actually, they should think this is the opportunity to bring about the real sea change. London, the Metropolitan Police, we've said earlier on, is the largest force in Europe. Does it need to be? No, it doesn't. Why can't we have? Why doesn't it break up into four? A south, a northwest, a southwest, separate forces. Run by separate chief constables, which are much more closely connected to the communities they're part of. Take away, as we said earlier on, take away those national responsibilities, which take up an enormous amount of resource and ultimately are politically motivated in some respects. Take them away, give them to the National Crime Agency, set up another agency if needs be to deal with those specific things. Get policing back to the grassroots. You have four chief constables operating in the four areas would still have populations of 2.5 million each, which is the second largest force in the country. The second largest force, West Midlands and Greater Manchester, have 2.5 million populations. So let's get it back to the level.
And therein lies the solution, because you look at the other, the other largest metropolitan forces outside of London is Greater Manchester and West Midlands. And by and large, they've certainly got two very good chief constables now, and they have over the years done very, very well. Peter Fahey, I used to work with Peter Fahey, and he did an amazing job at Greater Manchester Police. But I think you look in terms of the Metropolitan Police, one of the things that you suggested seems to me to be a no-brainer. Reduce the size of it. And by reducing the size of it, you have greater interaction with your officers, you have greater understanding of those issues, and it becomes much more of a movable feat, much more of a movable feast than it does if you've got a Metropolitan Police as big as it is now, which is absolutely massive.
It is. I mean, you've got so many layers of management, commanders, assistant commissioners, deputy assistant commissioners, you name it. There are so many different layers that you don't have in another force outside of London. And that means, as you say, the decision-making tree is enormous. So an officer in Oxbridge, in West London, coming across a really high-profile case, would have to go all the way through his or her borough commander, all the way through then to the area commander, all the way through to before it ends up in Victoria in the desk of the commissioner's desk or something. But as you say, as we've said, making it more manageable, so you have an area that's the size equivalent of another chief constable area, so the equivalent of Manchester and Birmingham, West Midlands, in such a way that makes it so much easier for people to know what's going on, to also ensure that people are skilled to do the job, that lines of accountability are stronger. It seems to me the simplest thing to do, and probably ultimately, would you believe it, saves money. But, I don't see a government with a plan. I don't see anybody with a plan other than we need a new commissioner.
That's not the solution. The solution is make the Metropolitan Police manageable, make it much smaller, remove the levels of management so that there is a much, much more direct line from the frontline officers up to the senior management. That would streamline, and that would make such a massive difference. And why on earth somebody within government or somebody within the Home Office cannot see this and start shouting and going, this is what we need to do?
Because they love firefighting. They don't like planning. I was going to say that we're really good at firefighting. We're not even good at that either. But they love responding to a crisis. Here's a crisis, let's deal with it. Rather than thinking, how do we prevent crises happening in the first place? And, I wish to God, people have been saying on Twitter that, Mark, you and I should run the police. God forbid that ever happens. But what should happen is what we said should happen. Make it more manageable, bring down those lines of accountability, make it a police force for its citizens and not for its politicians.
I want to just talk before, and I'm conscious of the time, but I just want to talk about this idea of taking refugees into your house. So the government have said that they will pay £350 a month to a householder to have somebody come in, and they've already had thousands and thousands of people.
100,000 plus.
It's 100,000 plus, yeah. So a lot of people. But you still need a visa, so there is a still requirement for that. But what worries me is, by and large, those people have got absolutely the right intention to householders. They want to offer an address to somebody who is coming from Ukraine. But this has the ability to be a big human trafficking issue in terms of bringing people into their house, getting paid for it, and trafficking them.
This is, you always bring a downer for everything, don't you? No, you know, I've thought about it, because we don't vet these people. And very often, the husband, the father, has been left behind to fight the war. So that most of the refugees that I've certainly seen on the television
are women.
Women and children. We put women and children, obviously they're going to hopefully decide ways of being able to ensure that their safety and security. But you know, criminals, the first plane that arrives after an earthquake is full of human traffickers. Mm. You know, Red Cross and Red Crescent turn up second. You know, so you can rest assured that the organized criminals, the modern slavery honchos, etc., are already well engaged in this subject, sadly.
Over you come. You can live in my house. You know, I want your passport. I'm going to look after your passport for you. Now, off you go. You work. Now, whether that's in domestic servitude in terms of trafficking,
forced
whether
labor,
that be forced labor or whether it's sexual exploitation, one of those or all of those will be elements that these criminals have got onto. So when I hear somebody saying that, and of course, you know, you and I live in the dark world, that's what really worried me. And I also worried me, and I don't know, and the government haven't been entirely clear on this yet, other than to say they are not going to manage it. This is going to be managed by local individual authority. Charities, local, but it will
we
not be
we don't have the resources
the
or the skill set, and who are going to be rather keen to get the people off their books, so to speak. That's why we've got to be vigilant. I'm hopeful that there are other people like you and I who are thinking right now, yes, we need something in place to ensure that we check on everybody and their welfare. Just because we've deposited them somewhere isn't the end of the matter.
Absolutely.
We'll keep an eye on them. We'll give them a route to safety. We'll give them a telephone number that enables them to seek help immediately. We'll keep regular support, regular visits, all that kind of stuff. That ought to be second nature. Sadly, I don't think it is, but that ought to be second nature. And that's how we protect them.
But I haven't seen anybody come out and talk about this whole aspect of the worry of trafficking of people from Ukraine. And as you say, by and large, those people who are coming over here are going to be women and children.
Yeah.
And by their very nature, they will be vulnerable because they're coming from a war-torn country into this country, right and ready for exploitation. And that really, really worries me. And I think the numbers are going to be really significant as well. Because as you come over here,
I think, you know, given that you've raised the issue and we've discussed it, I wonder if our listeners can have a think about this as to what they think ought to be put in place to provide the level of protection and security that these people need. As you say, they are some of the most vulnerable people in the world, never mind just in this country. And we need as many ideas, because as you say, nobody else is talking about it. So let's us begin that conversation.
Brilliant. Listen, well, our thoughts remain with those people in Ukraine who are going through the most unimaginable time at this moment. And thank you for the listeners. You continue to support Nazir and I as we talk about the topics that we feel are relevant to you. But do drop us a line if you want us to talk about something else or consider something else, or just drop us a line and tell us how brilliant you think our podcast is. A pat on the back is always welcome, isn't it, Nazir?
Of course it is. Of course it is.
Thank you for listening, and we'll be back with you next week. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kayes, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.